It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm in my 50s, and the thing is, I've sort of always felt like I was in my 50s, and I just kind of grew into that age. Well, apparently, I am a statistical outlier. Researchers have found that on average, people over 40 see themselves as 20% younger than they actually are. So 50-year-olds think of themselves as 40, a 65-year-old maybe is 52. This concept of how old you are in your mind is called subjective age, and it's not always in line with our actual calendar age. We're talking about age and why we often feel younger than we actually are. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel your age? Have you always felt that? Do you feel like you are younger than the calendar claims you are? If we ask you, how old do you feel? What is the number you would share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of the forthcoming On Grief, Love, Loss, and Memory, which won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize when it was first published in the magazine. She recently wrote about this idea of subjective age and why it's often different than our real age. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my God, it's so nice to be here. How are you?
Good. Well, you went looking for research on this idea of subjective age. There's not a ton of it, but you did find some. Tell us what researchers have found.
I did find some. And, you know, here there is a lot of research if you're just looking in the field of gerontology. Like, people have been asking since the 70s, how old do you feel? And to me, this is like a boring question because lo and behold, if you feel younger than you are, you're probably in pretty good health and you probably are going to, you know, live longer. This to me is, you know, one of these dispatches from the Department of the Extraordinarily Obvious, like, duh, right? I was interested in the question of how old are you in your head? Mm-hmm. Like, how old do you perceive yourself to be mentally? And you're absolutely right. There's a lot less about that out there. The most interesting study that I found, the one with the most sort of inspired way of framing the question, which was how old are you in your head? It was nicely designed. It had a big sample size. It had like 1,000 people in it. And it found that, yeah, if you are north of 40, odds are statistically, you are going to think of yourself as 20% younger than you are. But here's what was also interesting. If you're younger than 25, you're going to think of yourself as older, which sort of makes sense intuitively to me from both directions. Apparently this made no sense to you. For what it's worth, it made no sense to my husband either, who looked at me as I was writing this and like kept crossing his eyes and saying, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, but that's why anyway. This is so fascinating to me, because I don't, like, if you threw that question at me, I would like, I guess I feel my age, but so many people, I think you included, and a lot of people you just threw that question at, they instantly respond with a number that's lower than their calendar age, right?
And lower than 20%. Like, I was surprised. I mean, when I speak to people, just my informal, you know, N of 100 or whatever, I mean, it's way lower. You know, I was by no means weird as a 53-year-old seeing myself as a 36-year-old. Like, that was pretty consistent. And once I wrote this piece and the cascade began on Twitter, it had this like unusually viral life, this piece. People were giving me all kinds of really young ages that did not correspond, frankly, with the 20% shave off. It was much closer to 30 and 40. And oh, by the way, if I can just say, mm-hmm. one of the most common answers that I got on Twitter that I think speaks to this, and which would suggest that it's a lot less than, or a lot more than 20%. I can't tell you how many people wrote to me and said that, like, they would drop off their mother at assisted living and their mother would look at them and say, mm-hmm. please don't make me stay here. It's filled with old people.
Yeah, I remember my grandma complaining about all the senior citizens, you know, in her mid-70s.
There you go.
Yeah. Now,
and what was she? I mean, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know the age she thought she was, but it wasn't her actual age, that's for sure. Now, right. What do we know about why? Why do we do this?
Okay, so I'm glad that you asked. I find the answers that social science gives incredibly unsatisfying, which is not surprising. I think you really need like novelists to answer some of the most interesting questions, you know, that kind of come out of these lines of inquiry. I mean, they all gave answers like, it's ageism, right? It's internalized ageism that Americans and Westerners just consider aging a catastrophe. And we have some, and there's some evidence for this. I mean, because when you look at the cross-cultural studies, people in Asia and people in Africa shave less, shave fewer years off of their age. So on the one hand, maybe there's something to that, because in Asia and in Africa, there's more respect for the elderly. There's, you know, in Japan, there's like respect for the aged day. There's all kinds of things, you know. So yeah, I get that. But I think that there are a number of things. And I think one of them is that, first of all, it could be seen as a form of optimism that we think of ourselves as having, you know, one or two or three pivots left in us. So we don't think of ourselves as being the age that we are, you know. I think that some of it is that the older you get, you know, the smaller, a year is increasingly a smaller and smaller percentage or fraction of your life. So you're more inclined to maybe identify with an age where a year felt longer to you. I think that's a distinct possibility. I think also people identify with the age that they were sort of in a professional or personal sweet spot. That seems to happen a lot, where it's sort of their potential and their competence were in perfect equipoise. That seems to be a very common answer. So like for me, 36 was an age where I was still brimming with potential. I knew what the contours of my life looked like, but they hadn't been filled in yet, you know? So I think that's some of it. What are other answers? We spent a lot more time being younger than we did being older.
That's fair.
Some of it's just like a raw numerical response. I mean, I guess.
I'm talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about a piece she wrote about subjective age, the idea that the age we are in our heads doesn't always match up with what the calendar says. Love to hear your answer to these questions at 800-642-1234. If I ask you, how old are you in your head? Is it the same as your age, like it is pretty much for me, or is it different, like it is for, I guess, most people? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
It applies to me, and I think there's probably a segment that it applies to, you know, in the population is, I have three children, but I started later. I had my first child when I was 38. And I think, you know, the saying kids keep you young would be a big part of why I consider myself at least 8 years younger than I really am. And I think there's data out that says people are having kids later in life. And that may just be one possible reason that, you know, your kids force you to stay younger, at least mentally.
I'm so glad. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Jennifer, go ahead.
No, I'm so glad he said that. Mike is absolutely right. And I forgot to say that a lot of this is that we are deferring some of the things that our parents' generation did younger. And so that is exactly right. And I think that we have in our heads, and Mike probably has in his head, and by the way, I was also 38 when my kid was born, 37 when I got pregnant. I think we have in our heads an image of what 50 looks like or 40 looks like based on our parents. And also, you know, a generation ago or whatever, people smoked. They didn't have the same like skincare products. Their diets were worse. They did sort of in some ways look older in addition to sort of starting earlier. Somebody blew my doors off by recently pointing out to me that Carol O'Connor and Jean Stapleton and All of the Family, you know, when they were playing, you know, Archie Bunker and Edith, they were in their 40s. I mean, if you held a gun to my head, I would have said they were in their
60s. 50s, 60s, I would have guessed. 50s, yeah.
60s. Yeah, right.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. I appreciate it. We're talking to staff writer Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about her article on subjective age, the age you are in your head versus your actual calendar chronological age, and why those two numbers often don't match up for a lot of people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that where in your head you are younger than the number that, you know, is on the calendar, or maybe older? That is true, especially for younger people. if you're in the middle, I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jennifer Senior, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at her recent piece headlined, I'm 56 year old, I'm 36 in my head. We're talking about why it is that a lot of people feel younger, their mental self-image is younger than their actual age. And you can join in with your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi. My comment is, you know, I look at all these younger people around me and I just feel like, you know, I look at them, you know, the way the shape they're in and everybody complains about working. I've been working 70-hour weeks pretty much since I've been a teenager. And to this day, I still work those hours and they complain. And I think most of it's like the feeling of a work ethic and keeping in shape and just not being lazy. Everybody nowadays, these kids want to play video games. They want to do this. They want to do that. Nobody wants to work anymore. It's just like
I want to hear some numbers from you, Scott. Your age versus how old you feel or how old your self-image is.
I'm 56, and I feel like I'm 35 or younger.
Excellent, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, Jennifer, we heard Scott's numbers. He chalks it up to, I think, some of his attitudes and his approach to life there.
Yeah, I'm disinclined to actually say that it's because people have different work ethics. I think I would just have to respectfully disagree with him. I mean, I think that, you know, how old we are in our heads is sort of a function perhaps of how many good years we feel like we have left as productive workers. You know, I mean, I still feel like I could keep writing for the next 25 years if somebody wanted, you know, that's how I feel now anyway. And, you know, we've got like an 80-year-old president. We had until recently a speaker who was in her 80s, you know, I mean, There are examples of this all over American life of people who lead, you know, who lead constructive lives and until, you know, right through their 80s, you know, as octogenarians. By the way, just one quick thing. Mm-hmm. Did you say I was 56? Because you don't need to rush me. I'm 53.
53. Okay. I think we got a typo in the headline there. 53 years old, 36 in the head. Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Scott. I appreciate it. We'll go back to your calls. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi. I went back to college later in life, and I just always had this, like, funny experience on campus, like, you know, I'd be walking between classes and I'd have my backpack on, you know, and it's sunny out and I'm like walking along and I'm like, I'm 20 again, I'm 20. And then I'd be like, I'd catch myself like in the window reflection and I'd be like, oh my God, I do not look like I'm a 20-year-old walking around campus. But it's like funny.
I love it, Louise.
Funny how you get caught up in that, you know, or like, your mind's eye versus, you know, the physical reality.
Louise, thank you so much. That's a great story. And Jennifer, it reminds me, I think in your piece you talk about this is common where, you know, a 50-year-old is talking to younger folks and thinking they're one of them, and they lose that consciousness of that age difference.
I'm so glad she brought that up. Yeah, it was a great comment because exactly. A friend, so it's not a friend. It's somebody I really respect in our business who's a social scientist, and his name is Ian Leslie. He wrote to me privately and he said this on Twitter, and he said, I totally feel like I'm, you know, I'm 51 in plain old reality, but I also think of myself as being in my 30s. And whenever I'm talking to people in their 30s, I make the mistake of thinking I'm the same age as them. And I thought, oh my God, I have done that so many times in my life to the point that like, I will start, just as this woman said, Louise, I think her name was, like, you know, thinking she's 20, blah, blah, blah. I'll think the exact same thing. And then somebody who is in their 30s will say something to me that will make me feel like I may as well be Dame Judi Dench or Maggie Smith, that I might as well be like a dowager from Downton Abbey, you know? And you realize, oh my God, they think that there is just this distance between us that can be measured in light years, you know, it's just crazy. So it's always very humbling when that happens.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Louise. I appreciate it. Judy joins us now in Franklin. Judy, hello.
Good afternoon to everyone. I am in my 70s, but I remember when I was much younger, when we went shopping, and I'm thinking more female than male, there were places in the store that were set for older ladies. Their shoes were different. Their hats were different. Everything was different. And now, any woman going into a store, you go by brand or by size, but it doesn't necessarily set you with an age. And I think that may change how we reflect on age or how we see each other.
What an interesting observation, Judy. Thanks for that. What do you think, Jennifer?
I think it's a great, great point. And it goes to that point that I was saying earlier about, like, you know, I've got unguents that make my skin look younger. I don't smoke. None of us smoke. You know, I dress like my teenager dresses. I wear the same, you know, t-shirts and lucky jeans. You know, I mean, like, it's absolutely, she's absolutely right. I think that a lot of these distinctions have collapsed so that there's little reason. And again, and also we're deferring doing a lot of things that, you know, our parents did in their 20s. We're doing them in our 30s. So we've held over whatever our youthful selves were, and our clothing and our music and our, in all these ways. I think it's true. I think she's right.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic. She wrote about subjective age, how old we are in our heads versus by the clock and the calendar. Before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get this. You reached out to Margaret Atwood, the author, now in her 80s, about her thoughts on this. Can you share some of her response with us?
Yeah, it was delightful. It was very typically her. I mean, she was sort of saying, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm 83 and I kind of like being 83. And, you know, when you're 53, when you're your age, you're sort of self-conscious about how much older you are than other people and whether people are going to think of you as old. But by the time you're my age, you really are old. So the pressure's off. And she said, so, you know, I time travel in my head every now and then and revisit the decades that I liked, but I actually enjoy being old. And I actually, you know, take pleasure in it, and I make old jokes. And you'll see that in some ways it's better than being 53. There are advantages to being old. And I think she's sort of symbolic of the work of a woman named Becca Levy, who's an epidemiologist up at Yale, who has shown that if you have a very positive attitude toward aging, you also age well. And I think that Becca Levy's work has in common with the body of literature that says its opposite, which is that if you think of yourself as young, you also age well. What they have in common is that in both instances, you see yourself as being useful. Whether you think you have a positive attitude toward aging and you're like, hey, I like being in my 80s. I've got wisdom. I've got this. I've got that. I've got stuff to contribute. Or whether you're, you know, younger and think of yourself as even younger, you think, I have stuff to contribute. It's the same thought. And I think that that's what ties them together.
Let's go back to our callers. Nancy is with us now in Ironwood. Nancy, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your story, Nancy?
Well, I have a question. My husband is 65, but when he's talking about work, he's talking about how young he is and how he feels so great. And then we'll say something. The kids will say, hey, Dad, let's go snowmobiling, or let's go here and there. And oh, no, I'm just too old for that. I'm 65. I don't get why he goes both ways.
Interesting, Nancy. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah, I don't know. I like what he's doing. He's using it strategically. He doesn't want to go snowmobiling, and he'll use that as his excuse.
Total. It's like selective hearing. I think it is consistent with something else that people have said to me, which is that if it will depend on the day or the minute or the hour, you know, if you ask them how old they are in their head. So it could be true that Nancy's husband feels young, you know, at the office, or I don't know if he's at an office, wherever he's working, you know, it might not be an office, but if he's asked to go snowmobiling, suddenly he's thinking, oh, I don't want to, like, you know, on the off chance that we, you know, run over a branch and I get tossed out, I don't want to break anything. You know, I mean, I can feel incredibly young and then my knees will tell me something different, you know. I mean, it just depends.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. Time for one more caller. Janet is with us on the road. Janet, hi.
Hello, and she just mentioned her knees. So let me explain that I love this topic, and now you're giving a term subjective age to what I've been calling my emotional age. But I'm turning 71 next month. I think that's kind of funny. We have our chronological age. We have our what you're calling subjective age, where, as I'm saying, my emotions are, and I feel like a kid. I work with many people of ages at a seasonal job, and so I do speak to people about this, and they seem to like the topic of how old the stage is in our life. So our subjective age, and I think I'm in my 30s, 40s. But then you mentioned your knees, and that's the third one I usually add because it's how old our body is. And I've had so many surgeries, and I've had replacements, but it doesn't stop me from my subjective age of 30s and 40s.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jennifer, that takes us, I think, to a good point to wrap up with. I don't know, how can we embrace the best of our emotional age, as Janet says, or our subjective age?
I mean, I think that they're not incompatible, right? I mean, that's what I would say. But I think that it's true. Your knees are going to, and your hips or whatever, are going to tell you one story one day. But it's possible you're keeping your knees young by, you know, by having a different age in your head. It's hard to know, right? But I like her line about how she thinks that turning 71 is funny, because people do say to me that they look in the mirror and they just think that they've seen a system error, that there's just some kind of mistake. So I very much appreciated that aspect of her comment too.
Thanks for the call, Janet. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the book On Grief. She recently wrote about subjective age and why the age in our mind is often lower than our real age, especially when we're over 50. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever tried to learn a new language? Maybe you did it in school. Maybe you're in the process of learning one right now. Even if it was a challenge, research from around the world shows it's worth the effort. Being multilingual can boost everything from our creativity and critical thinking to our cognitive health. Our next guest has spent years studying the connection between language and the brain, and that's the subject of her new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with more than one language? Have you taken language classes as a kid or a grown-up? What was the best way for you to learn that second language? Did it come naturally? Or are you like me and it's tough to learn another language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Viorica Marianne is the Ralph and Jean Sundin Endowed Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Viorica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dig into the benefits of learning more languages, this is your life's work in a lot of ways. What is it that you find so fascinating about the connection between language and our brains?
I've always loved languages and been interested in the relationship between language and mind. I think most people think about us, our brains producing language, and don't understand that this relationship between language and mind is bidirectional. The languages we use also shape the way we think, shape our minds and our brains. So growing up with more than one language, I've always been interested in this relationship between mind and language.
Let's talk a little bit about how our brain handles language. There was some thought, I think, that, hey, here's a language center for our brains. And as we like analyze and scan our brains, we're going to figure out where language is coming from. If I'm reading you right, Viorica, it's a lot more complicated than that. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. So I actually myself, when I first started, was, you know, almost 30 years ago, was interested in seeing whether one language is located in one part of the brain and another language in another part of the brain. And that's a question I get asked often. But it turns out the brain is a much more distributed network of processing. So both languages share much of this network, and language itself is this broad network of activation in various areas of the brain that change depending on whether we comprehend language, produce language, whether we're focusing on meaning or form or syntax. So it's really a very complex neural activity.
Now, a lot of the history of the study of language has been on people who maybe speak only one language, like me. You and some of your colleagues are expanding that. What kind of things are we starting to learn about language by studying people like you who grew up with more than one language?
Well, you know, I think that if we only study monolingual brains and monolingual minds, we're missing a big part of the picture. And we're getting an incomplete and really inaccurate understanding of the human potential, of the potential of the human mind. And I think about this as being similar to how in the field of medicine, heart disease at one point was studied only in men and later found to be manifesting differently in women. Or diabetes was studied primarily in white populations, only to later discover that the indigenous populations of North and South America process sugar differently. In the same way, if we only study monolingual brains, we are really leaving out a lot of important information out. And especially considering that, in fact, the majority of the world's population outside the United States is bilingual and multilingual. So it's very, very common in many countries all around the world to grow up with more than one language. And even in the United States, those numbers are changing. So it is increasingly becoming important to not limit our research to a very small, narrow subset of what are called weird populations that represent only a small, so weird because they are coming from white, educated, industrialized, and rich democratic nations, which are the minority of the world's population. So in order to really understand the human mind, the human potential, we need to expand our definition of that.
Talking to Viorica Marian, her new book is called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're trying to learn a new language right now, we'd love to hear about that. If you grew up speaking more than one language, what was that like for you? How did it shape the way you think or the way you think you think? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into multilingual people here, Viorica. And one thing people might wonder about is for kids, the worry, and I wondered about this too, the worry that, okay, if a kid is brought up with two languages at the same time, are they going to be confused? Is it going to slow down their language growth? You have a pretty solid answer on this one in the book.
Yeah, that's a very common misconception. We often think that, and even advise people not to raise children with more than one language, and there is absolutely no evidence for that. Our human brain is built to be able to handle multiple codes of communication. And if you think of codes of communication as going beyond language and including other symbolic systems like math, like music, like nonverbal communication, you can see that the brain is able to seamlessly learn and integrate and master all these forms of communication. So multiple natural languages can be accommodated just as well. And you can see this in children and in infants all around the world growing up with multiple languages. And in the United States, we often see differences across social economic classes. So upper classes, upper middle classes usually understand the benefit of raising children with multiple languages and often, sign them up for lessons, language lessons, or hire tutors, or send them on programs abroad, and really understand that being bilingual and multilingual has all these benefits, economic benefits, social benefits, lifelong, wonderful outcomes. and encourage that. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we often have groups that are the lowest socioeconomic status that are actively discouraged from speaking another language under the assumption that that's damaging or confusing or bad for them. And there is, again, no evidence for that. And a lot of those recommendations come from biases that are really rooted in something else rather than really language.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Well, I'm just curious what your speaker's advice would be about the older people. I'm talking about retired people. What would be the best way for them to learn another language? Because there's many of us who did not have language when we were younger, variations of language. So I'm wondering what she thinks is the best route to go to learn another language.
Great question, Susan. Virika, what advice do you have for Susan?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this topic, Susan. It's actually an excellent topic. And before I go into the how, if you would let me, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the benefits for aging,
please.
And the aging brain. Yeah, so we now know that individuals who know two or more languages tend to develop dementia, Alzheimer's, and other types of dementia on average 4 to 6 years later than individuals who only speak one language. And countries that are bilingual or multilingual have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's. So it really does seem to be the case that having multiple languages and giving your brain this constant workout of juggling multiple languages translates to positive neural and cognitive health outcomes later in life, what's known as cognitive reserve and neural reserve. And the analogy I like to give is if you imagine taking a certain road home every day for many years, and then one day on your way home, that road collapses. If there are other roads that have been built to your house over the years, you will have no problem rerouting and getting to your destination. But if that's the only road that has been built, then you are in trouble. And in the same way, when you have multiple languages, if one neural pathway in the brain has been impacted and is no longer available to you, because you have multiple languages that have built memories, associations, experiences over the years, you are able to rely and compensate functionally for that anatomical deterioration. So it's a wonderful thing to learn another language as you get older. As far as how to do it, the one thing I would say is to choose something that you can engage in long-term, every day, systematically. So it's something that's sustainable. And then from there, choose a way that works best for your personality. Some people prefer to engage in social interaction when learning language. So maybe trade language lessons with someone. Some people prefer to do it on their own online. You can also trade language lessons online or use apps. There is a variety of apps right now that are built in a way that takes advantage of game design and rewards learning with all sorts of badges and pings and really gets the serotonin and endorphins and all the positive chemicals going, so you are motivated and inclined to keep up with your lessons. So whatever really is likely to get you to continue and stay with your practice will be very helpful. Make sure you do it regularly. And from there on, the only other thing to consider is just really think about what language you are most likely to find an affinity for. Is this a language that maybe means something for you because of your personal and family background, or because you have people you'd like to communicate with in that language, or you'd like to travel to that country, or you'd like to watch entertainment, consume entertainment in that language? So if you have something to which you're connected and you do this because you enjoy it rather than yet another thing to do, if you make it an enjoyable, pleasant activity, then you're much more likely to stick with it. And that's what it comes down to, like exercise or investing or anything else. If you do it long term, little by little, it's eventually going to produce the benefits that you're looking for.
Susan, thanks for calling. Hope that helps. We're talking to Virika Marion, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about speaking more than one language. If you do personally speak more than one, when and how did you learn them? Did you grow up, or did you learn them in school or on the job or in a foreign country? Let us know. If you're like me and tried and, you know, only sort of succeeded, you could share that story too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University, talking with her about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, about language, our brains, and the benefits of learning a second or third or fourth language. You could join in with your own story or your questions at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just wanted to let you know that in Milwaukee, for many years now, at least since the early 90s when my kids started going to these schools, we have at least four language immersion schools, Italian, I believe, German, French, and Spanish. And they learn in four-year-old kindergarten, five-year-old kindergarten, first and second grade. I believe they're only taught in the second language, whether it's German or Spanish or French. And then they're taught in both languages. And they learn to speak, to communicate with the teacher in the second language. And then when they're tested at the fourth grade for the reading levels, they score way at the top, if not first place.
Wow.
In the state or score. So you don't have to worry about them having problems later in learning because they learn very well.
I gotcha, Mike. Thanks for that call. Viorica, in our schools here in the U.S., often you don't have a foreign language option until high school. Some people like me don't hit one until college. What do you think of this idea, like as Mike talks about, starting early, much earlier, with something like an immersion school?
Yeah, there are multiple types of bilingual education, but the two-way immersion approach that Mike just mentioned is one of the best ways to bring up children with multiple languages. And by the end, they are fluent in both languages. And Mike is right. There are data suggesting that they score higher on reading and math scores, and this is true for both students from the language majority culture as well as for students from the language minority culture. So you see academic benefits, but you also see social, interpersonal, and personal benefits in terms of interpersonal skills, identity, self-confidence. It just seems to be a really beneficial way of raising children with two languages and results in fluency. So it's a wonderful model. It's very rare because it's more expensive to support, but it is absolutely an excellent way of growing up with two languages. And like we said before, in many countries around the world, it's the norm to grow up with more than one language. So my native language is Romanian. That's the language I spoke at home. And then the official language at the time I was growing up, because it was I'm from the eastern part of Romania, from Moldova, that was a Soviet republic, it was a Soviet territory, so Russian was the official language, and then English, and then a few other languages sort of get picked up, and then on my husband's side of the family, he grew up with Dutch as the native language, but also is fluent in English, German, some Spanish, some French, and that's really the norm in many places. So it can be a really enriching both linguistically and culturally and interpersonally experience.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Before I go back to our callers, Viorica, that you just reminded me of something that I think I learned from your book. You know, the second language is one thing, but that makes it easier to learn language number three, and then that makes it easier to learn language number four. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. With each new language you learn, it becomes easier and easier to learn more languages.
Why?
We don't exactly know. There are a number of ideas and theories. Partly it's because you just get better at learning, you know what to pay attention to. You also are better at controlling competition from the languages you already know and interference. But also with each new language, you have less new information to learn. So when you first learn a new language, there's just so much to learn from, you know, rules of grammar and meaning and form to meaning mapping. Then when you learn a second language, some of those grammatical rules are going to be the same. So you do learn, and even some words will be the same. So you learn new information, but not as much as the first time around. And then as you learn a third language, this third language will overlap in some ways with the first language, in some ways with the second language, with some in some ways with both. So if you think of it in terms of Venn diagrams, with each new language, your total surface of the Venn diagram circles grows, but the unique surface that's specific to just one of those circles becomes smaller and smaller. So learning promotes learning, and with new learning, you sort of become better at learning. It's not just for language. In general, sort of learning is this virtuous cycle. The more you learn, the better you get at learning.
Talking to Viorica Marian about her new book, The Power of Language. Back to your calls now. Robin is with us in Delafield. Robin, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just want to say I am 56, and I have a daughter who has lived in Sweden for 6 years. She's now a Swedish citizen, and I decided about a year ago to start studying Swedish. And it's just been... It's like, I consider it like my brain workout. It's been so challenging, but it's like in a really good way and frustrating too at times, just because when you just talked about learning other languages, literally there are times when I answer questions in my class, just like yes or no questions, I tap into my high school Spanish. It's hilarious, like what it starts to unlock in your brain when you do learn other languages, like other things pop up. But I have to say, I am all for learning other languages because, like you just said, it is such a good thing for our overall learning. And I feel like it's keeping me younger. And then it's also just providing me a level of comfort. You know, when I travel to visit my daughter, everyone speaks English in Sweden. But, you know, the whole culture and everything in writing is in Swedish. So it's just kind of a nice thing to have.
Robin, thanks so much for sharing that story. Viorica, Robin says her Spanish pops back when she's learning Swedish. I had that. I was never so good at German as when I was trying to learn Polish. What's happening in our brains when we're reaching for that new language we're trying to learn and it reaches back to that one we tried to learn before?
Yeah, thanks. And Robin's experience is wonderful to hear about. She is right to describe that's the word she used, brain workout. And that's exactly really, in a way, what happens. Your brain has to constantly work out to control competition from all these languages to make sure that you are using the language you need to be using and not the other languages. Cognitive, like right now, I'm speaking to you in English. I have to make sure my cognitive control mechanisms doesn't let Romanian or Russian or French or Spanish pop out because they don't do us any good. So your brain is constantly working out. And what's really nice about that is that unlike other types of cognitive exercise that people often engage in, like word puzzles or Sudoku, which, you know, of course, are wonderful and fun. In those cases, you have to take time out of your life to actively do those. But once you're fluent in another language, your brain constantly gets that exercise just by your way of being in the world, because you're constantly facilitating or coactivating, you know, prioritizing one language and then controlling interference from the other language, whether you are speaking, listening to music, reading, whatever you are doing, you have to juggle multiple languages. So it's a constant workout, which is why it's just such an enriching experience. But yes, Robin is right that all languages are coactivated in parallel. So our brain has to make sure it controls coactivation.
Thanks for that call, Robin. Just briefly, Viorica, you talk about languages. You know, we think of English and Swedish and Spanish and so on. But you also talk about music and computer programming and poetry as kinds of language. In just our last minute, how do they resemble those other things we think of as languages?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, of course, they are different in so many ways. But one thing that they have in common is that they're all symbolic systems. They all use symbols, which is what languages are, to encode, transmit, and decode information. As I'm speaking to you now, my brain uses the symbolic system of language to encode my ideas, to encode my thoughts into words, transmit them to you, and then your brain decodes them into ideas again and thoughts to be able to comprehend what I'm saying. The same thing happens with math, where we encode complex ideas into simple notations with music to really transmit information across time and space. So that's one of the wonderful things that languages enable us to do, including artificial languages like computer languages.
Eureka, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
That's Eureka Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. If you're grilling today, you're not alone. A lot of people will fire up the grill on the holiday. Here are some mishaps I hope you can avoid. They've all happened to me. One, I took some charcoal on a vacation. Didn't look to see how old it was. Probably hadn't stored it well. It's a long time ago. I was young and foolish. Went to grill dinner, and those coals would not light. Would not light. Finally, I gave up, cooked it all in the oven. Good thing it wasn't a camping trip, so I had a plan B. Two, I bought a new kind of charcoal one time. People are waiting for dinner. Wouldn't light. This one was not on me. It must have sat a long time in a warehouse or something. Result, gave up, cooked it in the oven. Three, I grilled a meal successfully, then closed it out by grilling dessert, a bread pudding in a cast iron skillet. I had a clever idea. The charcoal, still hot, didn't need to get hotter. I'd cook with the residual heat and close the vent on the charcoal grill. The result, a very, very strong smoky flavor to the bread pudding. Spoiler alert, that's not something you want in a bread pudding. I usually grill better than this. Hope you do too. This is Central Time.